I'm delighted to be here, and I think there are one or two things to say at the outset. One is that I'm not an expert on work. I'm no more an expert on work than any of us is an expert on our own emotional life. So I'm an expert to the degree that I work, to the degree that work is central to human life, to the degree that whether we like it or not, we think about it, and that it preoccupies us. So that is the nature of my expertise. But when I was contacted by John, and I have the failing of a lot of my generation, which is that if you're asked, then you feel pleased and honored to say yes, even though you may not know what you're going to have to say. So I said yes, and I suppose that itself is interesting from the point of view of talking about work, because that relates to the idea of a work ethic, the idea that some of us feel that it is a duty to work, and that we fit things in, whether or not we feel that we are able to do so, but we find a way to fit things in. What I'm going to try and do this morning, I'm going to talk for about 40 minutes, and what I'm going to try and do is say a little bit about work in the animal world. And I think it's important to do that, just to remind us that we are only just animals ourselves. And talking about work in the animal world will also allow me to broaden the boundaries of what we might regard work to be. Allows me to make the point that us humans talk about work, but really what we mean is work for which we are paid, when actually a lot of work goes on for which we are not paid. So I'll do a little bit about work in the animal world, and doing that also allows me to touch on the nature of play. And it's important to talk about play because in some senses we think of it as the polar opposite of work. And then it also, talking about work in the animal world, allows me to talk about idleness, because that's another way in which what we might think of as leisure. But I suppose given that I'm talking to the Seal Faith Network, I'm allowed to use a term like idleness because it has all the moral aspects of not working. So I'll say a little bit about idleness, and then I'm going to move on to then talk a little bit about what you might think is the reason for me having turned up, which is to talk about the impact of not working on human well-being, on human life. But actually, I'm not going to say very much at all about that, because I think Harriet Bradley already indicated what the factors are that may make us feel dispirited if we were not to be employed. And my real interest is to say something about why it is that people who work are so unhappy in modern society. And then I'll try and wrap things up. And I hope I can do all that in 40 minutes or so. So the idea of work in the animal world, it comes under, if you were to look it up, and when you were to look it up in the work of ethologists or social biologists, will come under the term time energy budgets, which is a kind of term that only a reductionist biologist would come up with. But nonetheless, it's a helpful notion, and it's essentially is a way of tying down the amount of time an animal devotes to feeding, to anti-predation, which is essentially controlling its space, and also the amount of time and energy expended on sexual reproduction. And we can say a little bit, so I can give examples for some animals. So for example, honeybees and harvester insects devote about a third of their time to various activities, one third to resting, one third to patrolling the nest, and one third to other kinds of activities in their environment. And And male orangutans, for example, spend about 55% of their time feeding, 35% resting, and 10% moving from one position to the other, and so on. And that gives you, I suppose it gives us an idea that energy is spent on various activities. And then, of course, there is a question, are there factors that determine how much time is spent on these various activities, given that they're not the same time across the different animal groups? And people have worked very hard to try to work out, to try to understand what might be determining this allocation of time and energy. And one of these theories is grown out of the observation that if you were to go to the Serengeti in Tanzania, that and you were to look at the lions, for example, as I have done, and they would lie there surveying the field, but there would be, you know, hundreds, perhaps even thousands of deer about, and you might think, given that there's so much, why aren't they killing all the time? Why are they just seem to be resting, to be idling? And there's this theory, which is called the theory of stringency, which attempts to understand this. And this theory essentially says that the evolutionary biology of this is determined by when you have the least possible to eat, not determined by when you have the most possible to eat. Because if it was determined by the amount of energy and time you put into looking for food, was determined by when you have a lot to eat, then when you haven't got enough to eat, you would all die off because you put a lot of energy into it and you wouldn't be able to get the energy supplies to keep that going. So it's very interesting to think that that it's determined by term times of famine, if you wish. And that's interesting from my point of view. Because again, if you were to look at termites, social insects, that they put about a third of their time and a third of their workers are resting and not doing very much work. In other words, they're surplus to need. And I've always thought that I found that interesting, that if only the NHS organized itself like that, if only the number of beds we had in the NHS was determined by the greatest need, rather than, in other words, the number of beds was determined by the need we have in the winter, not the need we have when there are very few people falling ill. Things will be much better. And if the termites can do it, how incredible it is that we can't manage it. We can't manage that thinking in that sort of way. So we got this theory of stringency, which determines some of the things that we can observe. And then you've got a theory of allocation, which is determined by the environment that these animals live in. So, for example, if the environment has a surfeit of food, then the animals they develop, their evolutionary biology makes them develop a lot of energy spent, for example, on sexual production, because they need very little time to spend on food. Whereas if they haven't got enough food, then the amount of time spent on sexual reproduction is greatly minimized, because there's a lot of energy spent on natural predation, controlling the environment to ensure other animals don't come in, and so on. So the environment also has an influence on the distribution of time spent and energy spent on various activities. But of course, my interest in it isn't so much I'm not a zoologist or anything like that. I'm interested in it because I'm interested in human beings, in people, and the things that I take out of the sociobiology of work. One that when I go out on a Friday evening to the theatre in Birmingham, and on Broad Street, you see large numbers of young people all dressed up to the nines, and they're going into the clubs, and they've put a lot of energy into mate selection, and they're not being paid for doing it. And if you go on a bus, on the buses,
And you see young women with young children, and the energy that it takes to control the children, to nurture them, to look after them, and they're not being paid for doing it. And it's work. So it's, from my point of view, it's interesting to think that a lot of the work that's done, that's unpaid for, has in it the instinctual drives and also instinctual reward systems for it. So that you don't have to have external drives or external incentives or monetary and financial credit in order to do it. And it seems to me that for our purposes, for our discussion, one of the things that seems apparent is that we get paid for doing the things which haven't been inscribed into the system as animals. And I think, again, that probably links to what Harriet Bradley was saying yesterday about the fact that caring, for example, is undervalued. But it's only undervalued because there's a kind of implicit notion that it's own worth, it has its own value, it has its own intrinsic value. Therefore, therefore it doesn't need to be paid for. I'm not arguing that we ought not to pay for it, I'm just trying to understand what the driving force behind our not paying for it might be. So the discussion about the animals is only an attempt to ensure that we look beyond paid work so that we understand the nature of work far beyond what we would normally regard as work in the current systems. I think what I want now to do is to talk a little bit about play. And one of the reasons I wanted to talk about play is because some people want to argue that if only work were more like play, we would be pleased to do it. And that made me think that we need to understand what the nature of play is. And some people also want to argue, and I certainly don't agree in a kind of ordinary sort of way about this, want to argue that if we were to look at modern hunter-gatherer societies like the San people in Namibia and in South Africa, that the nature of their work is much more like play. And my reluctance in just taking that sort of desire to take that sort of account on board comes from the fact that these sort of ideas come from Americans, and I think to myself that if you knew how hard the life of a San person was, if you knew that it is short and brutish, that the person is dead before they're 45, if you knew that their life is constrained and restricted and very, very few choices, you would hardly be holding it up as something highly desirable, given all the freedoms and all the all the things that are desirable in modern life. So, but having said all that, that's just my own way of saying that it's a bit irritating to have current contemporary human beings being regarded as like a noble savage of some sort. So I have my own worries about that. But having said that, I think there are things to be learned from looking at what it is that's interesting about play. And I don't particularly want to go into definitions, because definitions that can be absolutely deadly and tedious. At a simple level, we could say that we all recognize play when we see our kids or grandchildren play. And we also recognize it when we see dogs and cats do it. And at one level, it is simply kind of mimicry in the juvenile of what is recognizable adult behavior. So at one level, and I think for today's purposes, that's a good enough kind of way of thinking of play. And you could argue that it is just a way of practicing. So if you were to look in the animal world, that the juveniles are learning particular behaviors of how to run and how to chase another animal and how to jump on that other animal and so on. So essentially, it's a way of practicing what you might be expected to do. And I suppose in the human, the easiest might be if you've got a child who is learning how, you know, pretend play or how to be mommy and daddy or how to be a doctor or a nurse or something of that sort. So that's a kind of way of thinking of it. And I think that the two other things to say about play, is that it must be extremely important, serious business, a bit like sleep. And if I talk about sleep first, that we all do it at the same time, at night, and a whole village is doing it at the same time. It don't make sense. Well, it doesn't. You know, if you're worried about enemies, it don't make sense for all of us to be paralyzed at the same time. So the biology of that, the way that's developed, it must be really important to the brain that we sleep, otherwise we wouldn't all be sleeping at the same time. And play is a bit like that, that the juveniles sometimes are playing with adults who are really bigger, much considerably bigger, and they could be easily done injured, very easily. And they're focused on something which apparently looks useless. So the time they're focusing on that, all sorts of other interesting things could be going on. They could have their prey on them, and they could all be killed off and so on. So it must be quite important for the biology of it, for the evolutionary biology of it. It must be quite important, otherwise they wouldn't be doing it at all. So that's one thing to say about it, that it's really serious business. And the other thing about it is, it must be even more important than the human, given that the people who do it for a living are the most highly valued humans in terms of how much we pay them. So if you were to look at the footballers, or you look at actors, we pay them a lot of money to be doing what is essentially play, in quotation marks. So they are doing play for a living. That's what, you know, they're doing it as a job. And that's how elevated play is. And so, of course, we can see the value of it in the sense that it's creative, that it is, how shall we say, that it is naturally motivated, so it's its own reward. So you don't, you know, when we're doing it with our children or they're playing amongst themselves, they're not getting paid for doing that. It is naturally enjoyable, so it is self-motivated. It is self-chosen, self-directed. And it's almost always, except in the last 15 years, where people are now doing it on, you know, playing on computers and playing it on game boxes and things of that sort. Generally speaking, it is done in company. But even with the games, you've got people playing online with thousands of others, even though they never met them. So it's done in company. It's a social. It's a social matter. It's, you know, you can hardly play on your own in the real sense of the idea of play. And the reason for isolating those matters is that, of course, what I want to argue, or what I like us to ponder, is that those aspects of play, the fact that it's self-motivating, that it's self-chosen, self-directed, that it's done in company, that those aspects of it may be the things which have become missing in modern work, and that if they were to be part of modern work, then that word might be even more fulfilling for people at work. So that's play. And then, of course, I want to say a little bit about idleness. And of course, idleness is, I've said a bit about it already, that you, if you were in the Serengeti, that you can see the leopards, and you can see the lions idling. And that the termites also, you know, have a troop of idle workers who seem not to be doing anything at all, except that they are ready in times of crisis to be called out as if they're the territorial army or something of that sort. So idleness is interesting, and of course I'm particularly interested in it because it has that connotation of the idea that the devil finds work for idle hands. So there's a kind of moral idea, there's a moral notion that this is not something that we like. We'd rather you be working. And of course, Bertrand Russell wrote that wonderful essay in praise of idleness, because the title itself is ironic. I mean, he could have said in praise of leisure, but he chose idleness in order to make the point. And his case is that that we overvalue work, and that given the technological advances of his time, and we're talking about the 50s now, that he thought that we could easily have reduced working hours to 4 hours, and that therefore there would be more time released for idleness, which he thought was a basis of human creativity and development in human life and so on. And he I'd read out one of two things that he had to say. He said, the idea that the poor should have leisure has always been shocking to the rich. In England, in the early 19th century, 15 hours was the ordinary day's work for a man. Children sometimes did as much, and very commonly did 12 hours a day. When meddlesome busybodies suggested that perhaps these hours were rather long, they were told that work kept adults from drink and children from mischief. When I was a child, shortly after the urban working man had acquired the vote, certain public holidays were established by law, to the great indignation of the upper classes. I remember hearing an old duchess say, "What do the poor want with holidays? They ought to work." People nowadays are less frank, but the sentiment persists and is the source of much of our economic confusion. And he concludes, when I suggest that working hours should be reduced to 4, I'm not meaning to imply that all the remaining time should necessarily be spent in pure frivolity. I mean that 4 hours work a day should entitle a man to the necessities and elementary comforts of life, and that the rest of his time should be his to use as he might see fit. It is an essential part of any such social system that education should be carried further than it usually is, and so on. So he's not making the case for a kind of passive idleness. And in fact, he makes the point that the passivity at present, at his time, of sitting back and being at the receiving end of a cinema film was not good. I don't know what you think now about what we're like with the TV. So he wasn't making a point for passivity, and even though he used the word idleness, he actually meant something quite active, something quite creative in its nature. But I thought it's important for us to keep that idea of idleness and rest and leisure in mind as we think about the nature and the worth of work. And I want to say, to speak for 2 or 3 minutes, I don't need to say much more than that about what it is like not to be working. I think we know, it is well established, there's nothing clever about it at all, that unemployment is associated with psychiatric disorder. What we don't know, what's been far more difficult to work out, is what the direction of causality is. So we don't know. You might think instinctively that being unemployed makes you unhappy, therefore you got a depressive episode or a depressive illness. You might think that that's the direction of causality, but the reverse is equally plausible, that you've got a depressive disorder, your motivation is affected, your concentration is awful, your self-esteem is terrible, therefore you're unable to do the work that you've got, therefore you're sacked. So the causality direction, we don't know what the causality direction is. I think if you read the literature, it depends essentially on the political views of the individuals doing the writing. In my day, when I was training as a kind of south north south divide on the matter, so the guys in Edinburgh who were very interested in suicide were very keen to make the point that Margaret Thatcher's economic policies that deprived large numbers of people of work in the UK, and the suicide rates and depressive episodes spiraled, and therefore it was her fault. And the guys working on suicide in Oxford made the reverse case, that it was the fact that these people were already low-spirited that made it impossible for them to work. Therefore, it wasn't the work that caused it. So I think, of course, when you hear those sort of arguments, it's quite clear that both sides will have point. So I don't think we can say it's one way or the other. It's no doubt at all that in the 30s, in the economic depression of the States, lightsabers killed themselves. And we also know that in the current climate we're in, since 2008, there have been marked evidence of suicide rates linked to the fact that people don't have work and so on. And it makes sense that if you're dispirited, that you might feel like that. So I think, and that's all I want to say about it, I think that's established. And we can guess at the underlying reason. You can see that if it's working from the unemployment to the illness, that it could be something to do with loss of status, loss of contact with other human beings, because we're social animals, and when our social field is disrupted, that affects how we feel inside ourselves and so on. And so we can see how that we can make a plausible argument for it. So I don't need to say much more about that. I think what I want to do and end on is to say a little bit about the fact that people at work are unhappy as well, and that is curious given how valued work is. But they're not unhappy in all countries. So I do quite a lot of work abroad. And I was saying to John this morning that if you sit around the table in Birmingham at lunchtime, there's hardly a positive word to be said about the nature of work. And I've just come back from Singapore, and I've also spent 2 months in Perth this year. And nobody complained around the lunch table. Not a single person. And so there are cultural aspects to this. So that it does look as if in Europe and North America there's a kind of dissatisfaction with work. May be a reflection of the economic phase that Western Europe and North America are in comparison to the rest of the world. Not to do with the wealth, because of course there's no doubt that Western Europeans and North Americans are very, very, very wealthy, very affluent by any standards. And if you were in Lagos, which is as poor as it comes, and people work exceedingly hard and get paid pittance for it, they complain, but they complain about their politics. Very, very rarely are they complaining about their work. All right, so it's not to do with money either. So it's interesting to start to think what might be the problem. Why might Westerners and North Americans be dissatisfied and so on? And I hope you just accept that they are dissatisfied. But if you didn't accept it, I mean, if you take a look at the NHS, which has been very, very well studied, vast numbers of people off work sick, large numbers of them complaining of being stressed. And they itemize the reasons for it. They say that there's erosion of autonomy, a lack of control of their work, that there's a rigidity of the hierarchy, that they do tasks which are below their grade, that lack the right tools, or the tools for doing the job are broken. And I thought that was very interesting. When I worked in Nigeria as a doctor, we lacked the tools, but we weren't unhappy. Very interesting, that. So that I would see a patient, and I would know what we needed to do, but we wouldn't have the tablets or the drugs. But we didn't go home crying or anything. I mean, maybe we ought to have. But it's interesting that these people who are affluent, well-paid, work in relatively secure environments, are complaining that they lack the tools. I mean, what tools do you lack in the NHS in comparison to which country? You sort of mean. So it's very interesting that. That there's an increase in patients' expectations, there's an increase in administrative duties, there's organizational confusion, isolation from other team members, and that the colleagues don't understand their role and competencies, the roles that these people have, and so on. So there are all these things that people say when they're asked why it is they're unhappy, why it is they take a lot of time off sick, and also stay off sick. And one of the other tasks I have is working for an insurance company which insures doctors, nurses, and dentists, and considerable numbers who have absolutely nothing wrong with them trying to get off not working and get somebody else to pay their salaries so they want to be ill when there's no evidence that they're ill. And these are doctors and nurses and dentists, unbelievable, really. But the serious point I want to make about it is to say that it seemed to me that when you look at the underlying issue here, which is not mentioned it's a lack of trust. That the system doesn't trust the people to do their work. And that the system creates all sorts of what Michael Power, who is a wonderful book, who is a professor of accountancy at the LSE, wonderful book if you've got the time to read it. It's called The Audit Society. What he calls it the Audit Society, that there is this undue preoccupation with auditing and checking and monitoring, and there's a whole army of people who do it, which is just a reflection of this lack of trust that people will do what's right. It is a matter of fact that there are some people who will not do what's right, but they're in the minority. But a lot of energy spent on that aspect of things. And I think it's worth saying that Honor O'Neill's Rith Lectures in 2002, where she takes this subject, and again, I'll just read one or two things that she said. She said, perhaps the culture of accountability that we are relentlessly building for ourselves actually damages trust rather than supporting it. And she quotes Samuel Johnson, who said, it is better to be cheated than not to trust. That's how important trust is. The idea that we would go, drive down our own local high street, and that because people can't trust that we've got a driving license, they would have to stop every single car to check whether we got it. We're all driving day in, day out. We have to trust that the other person coming on the knows what they're doing. Otherwise, you couldn't drive. I mean, that's how fundamental. That's not to say there are people who don't know how to drive. They exist. But you have to operate as if everybody on the road knew what they were doing. Otherwise, you couldn't do it. So trust is so basic. And it does seem, of course, the most recent example of the kind of immense distrust is the idea that every single adult who is going to come in contact with a child is a potential child abuser. And imagine how disruptive that is to how society is organized, that you see something that you see a child on the street who looks distressed, but you are fearful to be involved, just in case somebody thinks you're a dirty old man. I mean, that tells you something's terribly wrong with how society is organized. But to take that back into the workplace, to talk about the fact that in the workplace there's this kind of lack of trust in the workplace, which is having an impact on how people feel at work. So Michael Power, he talks about the rituals of verification. And he concludes, and I like his conclusion, he said, the more one thinks about it, the more apparent it is that the imperative never trust, always check, could not be a universalizable principle of social order. So that, it makes the point that you can't operate society on the basis of constant monitoring, constant target setting, lack of always a top-down directive to the individual, and so on. And trying to draw to a close, draw to my conclusion, I think that the point I want to make now is not so much to say that the Japanese system is wonderful or incredible or anything like that, but just to use the idea of the Toyota kind of culture to use it to make a point. So if you think of the West, the factories in the West have developed out of Fordism, that Ford decomposed the task so that the workers in his factory never made a completed car. All they did was did a component part of the task. And he had economic reason for doing it, because that was, in his way, the best and cheapest and most efficient way of building a car. But of course the problem was the pride of the worker in being fully involved in the end product was greatly minimized, because he wasn't involved in the making of the real car. All he did was put the tires on, day in, day out, the same tires. And then you take a look at what the Japanese do, and it's cultural. It's nothing to do, it's not God-given or anything like that. It's cultural. So they have a team of people who all work on the car. And the tasks are flexible. So you're not just putting your tires on every day. And so your role in that making of the car is flexible. But you make that cut, so you are not just putting the tires on. And therefore, the pride of whether that car is faulty or not is personal. You have a personal relationship with the actual product. But more importantly, the team who made the car were allowed to decide how to make the car. They didn't have a directive about what method. There was incredible competition between the different teams on who could make them fastest and yet still safe and efficient and so on. And nobody came to say, you ought to do it in that order. All right, so there was freedom, there was a trust that the individuals were well-meaning, that they had an intention to make the best possible car. And nobody interfered with how they went about arranging it within their little group. So there are aspects of this, which is, goes back to 19th century Europe, which is that you're, as a workman, as a craftsman, you didn't have a tiny decomposed skill. You had the flexibility of a complex skill set. And that you were involved in making a real thing that you were proud of, not involved in your part component or anything of that sort. And that you had autonomy, you weren't being directed by somebody who was thought he was superior to you. And you had initiative about how you ought to go about doing it and improving it and so on. So those aspects, which of course very similar to what I've had to say about play, that there are aspects of play which, if they were to be instituted into work, might make work better. But of course, as you've already heard, that the lack of trust in the system and the managerial ways of working, which we've imported from the private sector in Western Europe and North America and brought into the public sector, erodes people's initiative and interest and self-worth and so on. So that even though they're in secure jobs, even though they're in jobs that they enjoy, they ought to enjoy because they've chosen it, like in medicine or nursing, they're actually unhappy doing it. So to conclude, we work much like animals do, except that we get paid for doing some particular kinds of work from which we derive status, satisfaction, and often pleasure. And Francis Fukuyama, who's not somebody I would normally want to be friends with because he's quite right-leaning and so on, but he has a lot of interesting things to say about trust. And he says that trust is the expectation that arises within a community of regular, honest and cooperative behavior based on commonly shared norms. That is, we trust a doctor not to do us deliberate harm or injury because we expect him or her to live by the Hippocratic oath and the standards of the medical profession. And he says, he goes on to say that not now, trust has a very important pragmatic value, if nothing else. Trust is an important lubricant of social system. It is extremely efficient. It saves a lot of trouble to have a fair degree of reliance on other people's word. Unfortunately, this is not a commodity which can be bought very easily. So, in conclusion, since we humans are not merely humans, are not merely animals, work is not simply a matter of time, energy, budgets. It involves values, self-identity, self-esteem, self-development. And the drive to work ought to include aspects of play, initiative, communality, pleasure, and autonomy. And as I already indicated, trust is at the heart of play. You couldn't play with somebody you didn't trust. And if trust is at the heart of play, then it seems to me also ought to be at the heart of work. Thank you very much.